of all the many creatures in God's creation, it seems to me that one of the most fascinating has to be the Pacific salmon, a fish that is born high up in the shallow waters of a stream where the mother fish has gone and hollowed out something of a nest in the gravel of the shallow fresh water, while the father stands guard, and then the eggs are laid and fertilized. They sink down into the gravel where they then grow until the salmon is born some several months later. It grows then to maturity over a period, depending on which type, for up to several years, and then begins an extraordinary journey down the saltwater stream and rivers, through the tributaries, and eventually to the ocean. And as you know, most fish are either freshwater fish or saltwater fish, but the salmon may, and in fact does, live in both. Having reached the ocean, the salt water, the fish then lives there for a period of at least 6 months, but upwards to 5 years, and then, in an even more extraordinary migration, reverses the trip. Travels sometimes as far or farther than 2,000 miles back across the ocean to the river from which it originally came, and then up that river, taking all of the right turns at the appropriate places, the tributaries, the streams, back to the very place where that fish was born years before, and there itself spawns in the conclusion of its long and amazing journey. A journey that fights the upstream battle against the downstream currents, a battle that at times requires the salmon to jump as much as 10 feet in the air in order to scale waterfall that are going the wrong direction for its journey. An extraordinary journey that distinguishes the salmon, I think, from all other fish. I remember one time on vacation in Oregon, we went to a place to see the salmon, and I don't know a great deal about the fish, remember the information that was there given, and discovered that it really isn't too hard to tell the spawning salmon from other fish. And it's a very simple and, I think, memorable test that if it's going downstream, it's either not a salmon or it's dead. And if it's going upstream, then it is a salmon because they swim when spawning up against the current. Now, by human standards of intelligence, salmon really aren't all that bright. In fact, I'm sure it would be an impossible thing to measure their IQ. So how do they do it? How do they find their way across the ocean? How do they know which river, which tributary, which stream? I mean, sometimes I get lost going home. And they know when to turn right and when to turn left, although they've only once before been there. Oh, the biologists have all sorts of answers, some speculating that it has to do with the smell, that every stream and every current has a different smell to it and that the fish sense it. Lots of different theories have been offered. Lots of explanations on how they can so oppose the current and how they can leap so high into the air. But the ultimate answer is that that's the way God made them. That's the way they were born, and that's the nature that they have. And just as God gave a certain nature from birth to salmon, so he also gave a certain nature from birth to Christians. That just as salmon have certain characteristics then that distinguish them from all other fish, likewise there are certain characteristics that enable Christians that I find quite extraordinary. That enable Christians to swim upstream, to fight against the current, and to make it to the destination, in fact, to be victorious. In my measure of things, Christians are far more fascinating and more amazing than salmon. So much so, in fact, that you can look, in a sense, at all of the high-pressure currents and all of the swirling rapids of the world in which we live, and you can see the Christians. Christians who fight against the current, who go upstream when all others seem to be going the opposite direction, who make it to the destination of God's choice, these live ones, the Christians. It's amazing. It's amazing to see and has caused me once again to take another look at victorious Christians. Listen to a description that, written long ago, tells about what the victorious Christian is like. It's in the New Testament book of 1 John chapter 5 that everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. And everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know we love the children of God, by loving God and carrying out his commands. This is love for God, to obey his commands. And his commands are not burdensome. For everyone born of God overcomes the world. This is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world? Only he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, the first of the characteristics of Christians is belief. And of course, it ought to be first because that's what a Christian is. A Christian is someone who believes, someone who has faith. But that must be rightly understood. Do you remember in a junior high English class when the teacher was explaining something that you had never even thought about before and probably have not thought about again since? And that is the difference between a transitive and an intransitive verb. The good news is for those of you that were discussing that, coming to church this morning, because I know you're really looking forward to this, but a transitive verb is a verb that takes an object. In fact, a transitive verb that doesn't have an object, either stated or implied, is not only grammatically incorrect, but in a sense, it's not sense. It's nonsense. It doesn't fit together. There are many transitive verbs. Take, for example, the verb kill. So I may say, I killed a mosquito. So there's an object to the transitive verb to kill, mosquito. Or I killed a man. And again, there's an object that makes sense of it all. If you simply say, I killed, it doesn't make any sense. Or might say, I kissed. Now again, there must be an object, or the verb nor the action doesn't really make any sense. That stated or implied, something or someone must be kissed. Or another way of putting it is, unless there is a kissee, there is no kisser. So it's a transitive verb and it requires an object that receives the kiss. Now, in terms of truth, belief or faith are always transitive. They always require an object. Now, some people don't understand that. Every now and then you'll hear someone say, I'm convinced that I'll go to heaven when I die because I believe. Believe what? Or you'll hear a third-person reference and say, oh, she is convinced that she will make it through this great difficulty because she has faith. Faith? And faith in what? Belief and faith are always, in terms of truth, transitive in that they always require an object. Now, a Christian, then, is someone who believes that Jesus is the Christ. A Christian is someone who has faith or belief, but the object of that faith or belief is Jesus Christ, that he is the Son of God, that he became human, that he died on the cross for our sin, that he was buried, and that he rose again. Also understand that faith must have the right object. It is not just faith by itself. There is, of course, a huge difference between killing a mosquito and killing a man. There's a big difference between whether I kiss my wife or kiss your wife. And so there's a big difference between having faith in Jesus Christ and having faith in oneself, or having faith in some other alleged deity or some other religion. A Christian is someone who believes in Jesus. Then a second characteristic of Christians is birth. Birth, of course, determines nature. If you are born a salmon, then you have the nature of a salmon. If you are born a scorpion, then you have the nature of a scorpion. Salmon, of course, live in water, and salmon swim. Scorpions live on land, and scorpions sting. Understand, then, that salmon don't sting, and scorpions don't swim. And that Christians are those who have been born of God and therefore have the nature of Christians and not the nature of non-Christians. It is something that happens from the point of spiritual birth. Now, again, there is sometimes some misunderstanding here, for on occasion we will hear people say, I have always been a Christian. That, of course, is an impossibility. For while physical birth gives someone a physical life and physical nature, it is possible to have a spiritual life and a spiritual nature from God only when one has a spiritual birth. That, of course, is called in the Bible the second birth, and we have the common expression of someone being born again. It refers to the result of what happens when we exercise belief in Jesus Christ. So belief brings birth. We are born again, and we then have the nature of God. Those two characteristics come together in 1 John 5:1, where it says that everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God. But there's a third characteristic that cannot be separated from these first two, and that is behavior. We'll not take time to talk about it, but if you think it through, you'll realize that all behavior is a result of either belief or birth or both. And so it is that a Christian's behavior is the result of what we as Christians believe and that we as Christians have been born again. It's explained, in 1 John 5, that everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know we love the children of God, by loving God and carrying out his commands. This is love for God, to obey his commands. So there's belief, and there's birth, and there's behavior, but behaviors are two. The first of them is love, that we love God and that we love one another. On our study of 1 John on Sunday mornings, we have come to this so many times that I'm reluctant to spend even a couple of moments on it, for it has so often been told us that Christians are those who love God and who love one another. But there is an interesting change that appears here that is not elsewhere in all that we have read. For always before, it is stated that we love God, and that is shown by the way we love others. This time the order is reversed. Where it says Christians love others, and that is shown by the way we love God. I think another way of saying it is that the two are so essentially intertwined that they are absolutely inseparable. You may be able to take two pieces of paper and write out the two different concepts of loving God and loving other people. You may be able to academically and theoretically separate them, but in real life it can't be done. Because in real life, love for God, that is love that is vertical, and love for each other, that is love that is horizontal, are so intertwined that you cannot possibly get them apart. It's a package deal. It's part of being the family of God. You love the Father, you also love the Father's children. The second part of the behavior that is characteristic of Christians who believe and have received the second birth is obedience. Christians obey. If they don't obey, then they're not Christians. If salmon don't swim, if scorpions don't sting, then they're not salmon, they're not scorpions. If Christians don't obey, then they're not Christians. It's all a product of belief and birth. What do Christians obey? Well, Christians obey the Bible, because that's the best statement that we have of God's commands. Although, sometimes people do something that's kind of sad, actually, and that is come up with a list of extraneous and extra-biblical do's and don'ts that says, this is what a Christian is, that you have to behave in this fashion. And then what often goes with that is then an overlooking of what God has clearly commanded within his book. We can't do it that way. We have to be careful that we understand that as Christians, our belief in our birth results in obedience to the commands that are clearly stated within the Bible. For example, the Bible tells us that we're to tell the truth. So a Christian obeys that command, even though the pressure may be on to lie. In fact, there may be all types of streams, all types of currents putting the pressure on to tell a lie. But a Christian's behavior from birth and belief insists on obeying the commandment of God for truth. The commandment of God is for fidelity within lifelong marriage. That may, under certain circumstances, be a difficult thing, but that's the clear command of God. And so a Christian obeys that command. The clear command of God is that his name, or various names, be honored and reverenced. And yet, we live in a world where there are people who pepper every second and third sentence with obscenities and profanities, many of which are the name of Jesus Christ, or of God, or the Holy Spirit, or some combination of all of them. Yet a Christian is someone who speaks, uses words and vocabulary that reflect the belief and the birth of what it means to be a Christian. Christians are amazing people. I mean, extraordinary. Christians are amazing, are extraordinary because of belief in Jesus Christ, because of birth that gives a supernatural nature from God, and because of behavior that is love and is obedience. Except that all such statements of such characteristics, for many Christians, raises all kinds of concerns. There are those who say, I listen to all this and I read all this, and frankly, it becomes a weight that just about crushes me flat. So much so that for some people, they quit reading the Bible, they quit coming to church, and they quit listening to God. Because it's just too much. It's kind of overwhelming. God says to do all these things is just too hard in a world that is full of lies and of immorality and selfishness and sins. For those who say, it's too tough to abstain from sex outside of marriage. It's too unrealistic. It's too unrealistic to be honest in a competitive business where most of the others are dishonest. It's just more than I can do. Or they say, well, my situation's different. My marriage, my job, my neighborhood, my family, my circumstances, they're different from everybody else's, and so God's commands, they really don't apply to me. I'm different from all others. And it would be an unfair thing to expect me to go along with what God has asked me to do. How does God answer the allegation that his commands are simply too much? That he's expecting more than he ought to expect? That he's being unreasonable? It's explained in 1 John 5:3 that his commands are not burdensome. He said, oh, wait a minute, how can you say that? They are burdensome. They're heavy, they're hard, they're tough. Are they? Commands aren't burdensome when you love someone. Do you know the old story set in England before adequate public transportation to schools was provided, of the boy who walked so far to school every day, and as if that were not enough, he always carried another boy on his back, and how a tourist who was visiting the area for some weeks saw him coming and going each day. And one day, his curiosity could be restrained no longer, and he went up to this schoolboy and said, how do you do that? How do you carry such a burden on your back for such great distances every day? And the boy said, that's not a burden. That's my brother. You see, he loved him. And so he didn't think of him as a burden at all. I've seen people do extraordinary things for those that they love. I've seen wives care over long periods of time for dying husbands and to do things on a repeated basis which, under other circumstances and other times in their lives, they would not only tell you they could not possibly do, but that they would find absolutely revolting and disgusting. And yet they do it. When I know someone well enough, when I have the courage to speak, and occasionally I have said, how do you do it? How do you do the things you do in order to care for him? They seem to be terrible burdens. And the answer is, it's no burden. No burden for someone you love. In fact, it's a privilege. I've seen parents make sacrifices that I would consider to be unreasonable for their children. Parents who have given up vacations, sometimes given up jobs and houses, sometimes given up life savings, in order to meet some need for a child, not always a young child, sometimes a grown child. And even a casual observer wants to say, how can you make that kind of sacrifice for someone else? The parent says, you know, I never thought of it as a sacrifice before. That's an interesting word to use. I'm just helping my daughter, my son. I'm just helping. I'm glad that I can do it. And you see, God's commands are not burdensome to those who love him. I suspect that those who think that his commands are burdensome have perhaps spent their time weighing the commands instead of measuring the love. God's commands are not burdensome, not only because we love God as Christians, but also because God always gives to us the resources necessary to meet whatever expectations he gives to us. Isn't that wonderful? Perhaps to some even surprising, that if God calls on us to do something, that he will always give to us whatever we need. So if he is asking us to be honest in a business context that is largely dishonest, or if he is asking us to be faithful in a marriage that is a hard marriage to stay in, or if he is asking us to be loving towards people that are very hard to love, or if he is asking us to be decent when all of the speech around us is indecent, he will always give to us the resources to obey his commands and to meet his expectations. Now, none of that is to say that it's easy. None of it is to say that swimming upstream and hurtling over 10-foot barriers is a simple thing to do. But it is not burdensome, because we're doing it for the God we love, who promises to give to us the resources that we need. But there are others who say, I have a different concern. My concern is that as I try to live the Christian life in a context that is largely non-Christian, where the pressures are absolutely oppressive, it is like swimming against a fire hose. It's like fighting against an ocean current. I feel like I'm going to be overwhelmed. It's hard when everyone else is cheating in school. I feel like I'm going to be overwhelmed by the fact that lust is laid on us continually by the media. I'm not sure that I can continue in my neighborhood, or in this family, or through this marriage. It's hard to make it financially when other people are cheating on their taxes and I'm expected to compete on uneven ground with them. And I'm weary. I'm tired. I just don't feel like I can hang in there any longer. I'm afraid that I'm just going to be overcome by the world and all the people and everything that's in it until I'm going to collapse. To which God says, this is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. That God offers victory no matter what the odds. He offers victory no matter how hard the fight, and that the key to that victory is faith. But again, it's not just faith, but faith that has an object and faith that has the right object. Turn on your imagination with me for a moment and imagine that there are 100 of us standing on a huge battlefield of many square miles. And we are facing an opposing army of all of the Roman Empire, a million strong, clad in all of their panoply for battle, led by their greatest strategist, by someone like Julius Caesar or Mark Antony. And they're attacking. And you can hear the beat of the horse's hoofs, and you can see the reflection off the armor of the soldiers, and it's like a thunder coming at us. And I stand there, sort of yawn, and you turn to me and say, do you see what I see? And I say, don't worry, we're going to win. And you say, there's got to be a million of them. I say, yeah, but there are 100 of us. And you think, all right, let's divide up. That gives me 10,000 alone that I've got to fight. And they're getting closer and closer. And you say, how can you be so calm? And I say, I have faith. You say, well, use it. And then you say, faith in what? And then I point out some things. I point out that squadron of sort of a mix nowadays, MiG-23s and U.S. Phantoms flying over, carrying our colors. I mentioned to you that all those cruise missiles, some with tactical nuclear warheads, are connected to this little pad of buttons that I have in my hand. I mentioned that some of our 100 are operating those state-of-the-art tanks, and behind them are the heavy artillery ready to fire. And I explained to you that a combination of just one or two of the bombers or all of the fighters or the cruise missiles or the tanks or the artillery, it wouldn't take much, just a combination of a few. We wouldn't even need to use all 100 to wipe out an army of a million or more. And it is in that that I have my faith. It is not a faith that I have in myself. And you're impressed. In fact, you agree that we're going to win. We are going to win. Not because of my little faith, but because of the big object and resources of the faith that I have. This is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world? Only he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. For you see, Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has greater power and weaponry than all human armies of all of history combined. And while we would collapse and die dependent upon our own resources, we shall be invariably and inevitably victorious because of Jesus Christ. Now, it's true that sometimes the battle is hard and sometimes the battle is hot. The victory is guaranteed, and guaranteed in advance. It seems to me that such extraordinary truth from God demands some kind of response from us. Perhaps the response of someone who says, I need to be birthed by God. I need to believe in Jesus Christ so that my behavior will be changed. And some may say, you know, when I look at what God here says, that gives me a totally different perspective on my job, on my neighborhood, on my marriage, on my language, on my life. And so I'm going to live differently now with that perspective. I invite you to listen again to God's words and then to pause for a moment of quiet prayer, asking God what he's saying to each of us, and then saying yes back to him. Everyone who believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves the Father loves his child as well. This is how we know that we love the children of God, by loving God and carrying out his commands. This is love for God, to obey his commands, and his commands are not burdensome. For everyone born of God overcomes the world. This is the victory that overcomes the world, even our faith. Who is it that overcomes the world? Only he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. And so, our Father, now and then again, we ask that you speak to us individually. What do you have to say to us? We listen. We ask you to listen for us as we say, yes, in Jesus' name. Amen.
We welcome Neil and Diane Johnson to our witness stand this morning. They're going to share with us from their lives and from their expectations, I believe, as we start a new church. Thank you, Neil and Diane.
Guy, I've got a question for you. How'd we get up on this witness stand? Weren't we supposed to come to Wooddale, blend into the crowd, and not get involved for a while?
Well, we did rest for a while, and I guess that would be an easy thing to continue to do. But now God has led us to be involved in Wooddale's new church start, Woodridge. We first came to Wooddale last August, and in the evening service, Pastor Anderson's message was on, what to do when you are spiritually fatigued. That was exactly how I was feeling, and it was so reassuring to hear practical answers to the confusion I felt. I knew that God had led our family here. Through the past 10 months, I have felt the Holy Spirit at work in my heart, changing my attitude from one of being complacent to realizing that God does have a plan for me. I know in my own life it has been too easy to be comfortable and contented with all the blessings God has given us and lulled into an unconcerned attitude toward the world. But God's plan is to bring the good news of Jesus Christ to those unsaved people he brings into our lives. We can either choose to be a part of this plan or choose to ignore it. I've been a Christian since I was in the first grade, and all through the years my friends have all been Christians. And now I have a desire to get to know those that are unchurched, and I believe that is why God is leading our family to be a part of Woodridge Church.
The plan is simple. It's to build a core group of 100 Christians, to utilize direct mail and telemarketing to reach the Plymouth area and announce to them the start of Woodridge, and then through prayer and God's leading, network 200 unchurched with the core group of 100 and share with them the good news of Jesus Christ. You know, God's already at work in the Plymouth area, preparing the hearts of those he will bring to Woodridge. Pray that we will be prepared to meet them where they're at, build into their lives, and share with them this good news. We've chosen to be involved with Woodridge, and if that would be of interest to any of you, we'd love to talk to you about it. But our prayer for you this morning is that for those of you already involved in ministry, that you'll stay at it. We want to encourage you in it. And for those of you who are not involved in ministry yet, to get involved. The words of Matthew 9:35-39 apply so well here, I'd like to paraphrase it. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, and that's Eden Prairie in Plymouth, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them, because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field." Thank you.